The concept of American exceptionalism is not new. It has acquired a variety of definitions down through the years. And, of course, it's often been linked with a similar concept, British exceptionalism. Even our current president has entered the fray, essentially dismissing the idea altogether. Early in his presidency, he made the following statement: "I believe in American exceptionalism, just as I suspect the Brits believe in British exceptionalism and the Greeks believe in Greek exceptionalism." And of course, that is essentially stating that there is nothing exceptional or out of the ordinary about America or any other country, for that matter, that can't be explained by national pride and or an affinity for one's own country. From the Affordable Care Act to the reengineering of America's foreign policy to the rescue of large financial institutions and major industrial concerns, to the demise of the Defense of Marriage Act and support of same-sex marriages, our president has undertaken what many believe to be a personal crusade to transform America. Another one of his consistent causes or themes involves income inequality, or, as he has phrased it and others have as well, the redistribution of wealth. And, of course, all of this comes on the heels of our nation's partial and somewhat questionable recovery from a major recession that has thrust the United States of America into what one might call an identity crisis. Maybe there's nothing special or unique about America. Perhaps we do need to jettison the principles of democracy and freedom upon which our nation was built and embrace a more European model of governance, in which government intervention replaces individual and private initiative. Is this the answer to our current malaise? More taxation and more government intervention and intrusion? Well, these challenging and perplexing issues that are, of course, political in nature primarily, are clearly dividing our nation and threatening its survival. This afternoon, I'd like to explore this concept of American exceptionalism from a biblical perspective, not a political perspective. I shared some political perspectives with you to set the stage and to give you a little background for your consideration as we take a look at a subject that many of us are quite familiar with, but one that deserves a review in light of the current condition in which our nation finds itself. I don't wish to delve into politics this afternoon, but I do want to discuss the principles upon which our nation was founded and remind us all that the rise of the descendants of two brothers, Ephraim and Manasseh, was foretold in Scripture and was the direct result of God's promises to and His covenant with Abraham. So this afternoon, I would like to begin a two-part series of sermons addressing the question, what makes America exceptional? I'd like to begin by taking a brief look at the British Empire, because after all, we, that is the United States of America, are 13 little colonies, sprang from the British Empire and eventually became the United States of America. So I'd like to review for you, briefly, just a little history about the British Empire. And this is taken from the Historical Atlas of the British Empire website. To fully appreciate the significance of the Commonwealth, Britain's global position, it is important to understand its origins from the British Empire. Technically, there have been three empires, the first in France, lost by 1558, the second in North America, which became the United States of America after 1776, And the third was global, which became the modern Commonwealth of Nations after 1949, each one being larger than the one before. Now, as we consider the history of the British Empire, the Commonwealth of Nations, it has many names, consider the size of Britain, a small island nation. How on earth did they assume the position of global dominance that they achieved in their heyday, in their prime? It is amazing when you consider the odds against something like that happening, and we're going to see, of course, as we go through some of these statistics, just how remarkable their ascendancy was. So that was a brief distillation of the Commonwealth or the Empire. It is striking that when one looks around the world at the most successful countries, many of them have British colonial roots. Canada, the United States, Australia, India, Singapore, Hong Kong, the various peaceable Caribbean islands. Given the diversity of cultures, histories, and languages, it is the Commonwealth values of peace, order, and good government that have set those disparate nations on the path to success. And really, when you consider the variety of nations and languages and heritages that the British Commonwealth encompassed and embraced down through the decades, it is indeed an incredible variety. And when you see the British influence, both in their organization, in their form of government, in their values, in their customs, much of that is still visible and obvious, even when you visit some members of the Commonwealth today. If any of you have, for instance, visited Canada, Australia, even Singapore, it is quite a remarkable thing to witness and see. For instance, in Singapore's case, their thriving and strong economy for such a small island nation. And when you look just to the north and see all of Malaysia, it's hard to believe that really they're in the same part of the world, or cut, if you will, from the same cloth. There is something unique and different about those members of the Commonwealth and how they were able to come out of whatever they were engaged in their early years and progress to be the states and nations they are today. Even in Africa, you will see that the colonies affected by the British have essentially achieved a higher degree of organization and peace than several others. It's a tribute, I think, to the British, but it is also indicative of what God told us all He would do to the descendants of Ephraim and Manasseh, due primarily and, of course, almost exclusively to the promises that He gave to Abraham. And it is something that we're going to explore this afternoon as we take a look at both the British Empire briefly and then more specifically America. The British Empire consisted of various territories all over the world, conquered or colonized by Britain from about 1600. It was expanded by commerce, trade, and colonization, and sometimes by conquest. But overall, the empire was built on commerce. There were colonies conquered, but they were done for a reason. For instance, France hired the Mughal Empire to fight Britain. Britain then fought back and conquered the Mughal Empire, which made up the northwest corner of present-day India. The 19th century saw the largest expansion of the empire as the British took many former French possessions in the West Indies and began to settle in large numbers in Australia in the early part of that century, and later competed fiercely with other European powers for territory in Africa. At the same time, there were serious expansions in Asia, notably the acquisition of Singapore, 1824, Hong Kong, 1841, Burma, 1886, and the South Pacific, particularly the settlement of New Zealand in 1840. The final big expansion of the empire was following World War I, when former German and Turkish territories were mandated to Britain and the Dominions. The only serious loss of territory was the loss of the 13 American colonies in the American Revolution of 1776. That was their only major loss of territory. Unusual, isn't it? The older of the two brothers, Manasseh, was lost. And we'll talk more about those two brothers in a few minutes. Which became the United States of America. The British Empire was at its largest territorial expansion after the First World War, after 1918, until the 1940s, consisting of over 25% of the world's population and 30% of its area. All this from a small little island, barely a dot on the map. Since 1949, the British Empire was replaced by the Commonwealth of Nations. Most colonies are now independent. Today's Commonwealth is composed of former and remaining territories of the British Empire and a few non-former British Empire countries, which once belonged to other powers such as Portugal, France, and Belgium. The Commonwealth is a loose, voluntary organization dedicated to preserving human rights and democracy, and is held together by a desire for membership and the English language as well as history. It currently includes 53 nations. And I was not aware of how active and involved and engaged many nations still were in the British Commonwealth of Nations. Obviously, most of them, if not all of them, are independent, but still, the Commonwealth, the common goals, the common values, the common language is still an attractive factor that brings these nations together. As the old saying goes, the sun never set on the British Empire. And to pose the logical question again, how in the world could this small island nation impact the world to such a degree? Would you not call that exceptional when you consider what has been accomplished by the British Empire, Britain, if you will? Now let's consider Ephraim's brother, Manasseh, or the United States. Separated from potential enemies by two vast oceans, sharing borders with non-threatening neighbors, the possessors of vast stores of coal, iron ore, oil, natural gas, and abundant water, fertile soil, temperate climate, all of these elements allowed and enabled America to rise to superpower status, but it was not always that way, was it? Along with this incredible combination of natural resources and strategic location, America enjoyed something else that gave it a distinct advantage. Listen to John Adams describe the unique features of America's and Britain's form of governance that preserves and protects our freedoms. Quote, "The liberty, the unalienable, indefeasible rights of men, the honor and dignity of human nature, and the universal happiness of individuals were never so skillfully and successfully consulted as in that most excellent monument to human art, the Common Law of England." Now, the above quote was taken from an essay by Daniel Hannan, which he adapted from his new book entitled Inventing Freedom, The English-Speaking Peoples Made the Modern World. That's quite a statement in itself, isn't it? As far as the book title, How the English-Speaking Peoples Made the Modern World. Now, historically, I think that could be proven as a statement of fact. But by the same token, how many historians would recognize the promises of Abraham and God's intervention in this formula that created the atmosphere and environment, the opportunities, the resources, and all of the other elements that have come together to make these two nations, Britain and the United States, exceptional? I've not read any historian that points to the blessings of Abraham or the intervention of God when there is a discussion about the modern world and the influence of the Anglosphere, as it's been called. In fact, Daniel Hannan calls it the Anglosphere. His essay appeared in the November 6, 2013 edition of the Wall Street Journal, and I'd like to quote from that essay. "Freedom under the law is a portable commodity, passed on through intellectual exchange rather than gene flow. Anyone can benefit from constitutional liberty simply by adopting the right institutions and the cultural assumptions that go with them." That is not simple. That's very difficult. It's very challenging. "The Anglosphere, that is the sphere of influence exercised by English-speaking peoples, is why Bermuda is not Haiti. It is why Singapore is not Indonesia. And it is why Hong Kong is not China." That's the difference, according to Mr. Hannan, and I tend to agree with him. It's quite a striking comparison, isn't it, when you compare these nations with each other? In fact, did you read about the tunnel that was discovered from Hong Kong to mainland China? They were smuggling goods through the tunnel to the mainland. And, of course, there is a constant tension between Hong Kong and China. If you've ever visited Hong Kong or even flown by Hong Kong, it is amazing to see the tall buildings poking up out of what seems to be ocean. And the same with Singapore. It is remarkable to see how advanced these small island nations are and have become. It does seem clear that God was at work in many ways as these two exceptional nations, the United States and Britain, ascended to their positions of global dominance, including the blessings, the covenant blessings, bestowed upon Abraham's descendants. And, of course, in addition to those blessings, the biblical principles that served as models for the establishment of laws governing both countries, and these specific efforts of America's founding fathers to emphasize individual freedoms and the responsibilities that go along with them in crafting their governing documents, which serve to lay the groundwork for the unparalleled expansion of freedom, wealth, influence, and accomplishment our nation has enjoyed for over 200 years. And, of course, some would look at the fall of the Berlin Wall and Mr. Gorbachev's eventual exit as proof that communism failed, the Cold War was over, and democracy, capitalism was the winner. Now, once again, that's more of a political statement, but at the same time, I want to bring out that concept as we look at the world, its history, and the contemporary nature of the world today. We still see the Anglosphere in a dominating position as far as the influence they have exercised down through the decades and even the centuries. I'd like now to give just a couple of examples here to show a little bit about how God's hand was involved in all of this. I'd like you to consider Britain's precarious position as she stood up against the ravages of Nazi Germany's efforts to conquer the world. And, of course, I have a quote here from who else? Winston Churchill. These are the stirring words he used to bring Britain to its feet in defense of the small island nation. Listen to him describe the situation. And all of you, I'm sure, are aware of how dark and difficult it was during this time in Britain. "Hitler knows that he will have to break us in this island or lose the war. I don't know how many of you are familiar with William Manchester. He wrote a trilogy, a three-part history, biography, I should say, a biography history, if you will, on Winston Churchill. It was called The Last Lion, and indeed, he was the last roaring lion of the British Empire. And I think if you will consider what he has to say in the context of where he came from, 19th century, early 20th century in his growing and formative years, and his concept of the Commonwealth, the British Empire, and his grasp of where the empire stood at that critical moment in time when Hitler had overtaken most of Western Europe and was poised to leap across the Channel and conquer Britain. Listen to his words in the context of that situation. Hitler knows that he will have to break us in this island or lose the war. So he thought it was a winner-take-all. If he didn't take England, he was going to lose the war. If we can stand up to him, all Europe may be free and life in the world may move forward into broad, sunlit uplands. But if we fall, then the whole world, including the United States, including all that we have known and cared for, will sink into the abyss of a new dark age, made more sinister and perhaps more protracted by the lights of perverted science. Be it the experimentation on human beings or the creation of the B-1 and B-2 rockets and even the possible creation of a nuclear bomb. All of that was considered a possibility for Nazi Germany. And in fact, at the end of the war, they did successfully launch V-1 and V-2 rockets. Their destructive power was devastating on England, and yet it was too little too late. But the point here is this. Churchill recognized what was at stake. Let me conclude his quote. "Let us, therefore, brace ourselves to our duties, and so bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its Commonwealth lasts for 1,000 years, men will say this was their finest hour." And I think some would have to look back on that confrontation with Hitler and Germany and the way Britain sustained themselves as probably one of their finest hours, if not the finest hour of Britain and the Empire and the Commonwealth. But clearly, Churchill understood the stakes. And where was the United States for much of the early portion of World War II? They were not engaged or involved directly. They were supplying arms and munitions and other support. But we were not committed, essentially, until Pearl Harbor. And, of course, with the Pearl Harbor attack, the giant was awakened, and we entered the fray, and of course the outcome was eventually as we know it. I have another example that I'd like to relate to you, and some of you will remember this, others may not. Churchill called this the miracle of Dunkirk. The miracle of Dunkirk. This was in 1940, May and June. More than 300,000 troops, French, Belgian, British, were surrounded by Germans. And had those 300,000 troops been captured or compromised, the war could have gone in a far different direction. But listen to the account of how all of this came down and how 300,000 were miraculously evacuated from the beaches of Europe in 1940. At that time, Churchill said it was a miracle of deliverance. And according to this article that I pulled from the BBC website, a miracle is the best description of what happened at Dunkirk in May and June of 1940. Hundreds of thousands of troops were rescued from the German advance in the nick of time. The troops were desperately needed back on the home shores to help defend against a Nazi invasion. They were rescued from the harbor and beaches near Dunkirk by a curious assembly of many different types of craft. Many of the little ships, such as motor yachts, fishing boats, and all manner of floating devices, were used to evacuate these troops. And remember, the German troops were surrounding them. And it's an exciting story. I don't have time to give you all the details, but just the highlights should serve to illustrate the point. Although a large number of these ships were taken across the channel by Navy personnel, many were also taken over by their owners and other civilians, all eager to help in what had become a catastrophe. The British, French, and Belgian governments had simply underestimated the strength of the German forces in their equipment, transport, and firepower, which was far superior to much of Britain's outdated armory. And quite frankly, if you read the history of the situation, the British and French generals were still steeped in World War II fighting techniques and mentality. They were not used, or World War I, excuse me, they were not used to the rapid advance of troops by tanks and trucks. They were not used to air cover. They were not used to any aspect of the German advance. They got caught by surprise. It was an embarrassing and a humiliating situation. What was to become of them? The British Expeditionary Force, as well as the French and Belgian forces, found themselves defending positions against overwhelming odds. Before long, with the Germans effectively cutting off nearly all escape routes to the channel, the BEF, the British Expeditionary Force, found itself desperately retreating to the harbor and the beaches of Dunkirk. Vice Admiral Ramsay, who was in charge of Operation Dynamo, had sent destroyers and transport ships to evacuate the troops, but they only expected to have time to lift off about 30,000, one-tenth of them. However, before long, the harbor became partially blocked by ships sunk in consistent attacks from enemy aircraft. It became necessary to take the troops off the nearby beaches as well, something that was thought to be an almost impossible task because of shallow water. This is when the little ships came to play their part. A variety of motorboats, fishing smacks, trawlers, lifeboats, paddle steamers, and many other types of craft came over the channel to assist in the escape. They mainly ferried the troops from the beaches to the destroyers laying offshore, but thousands of troops came all the way back to England in some of these boats. The escape captured the minds and hearts of the British people at a time when it looked probable that we too would soon be invaded. It seemed like a victory in just getting the troops back, over a third of a million of them, to fight another day. How could that possibly have happened? Let's take a look at one more item, the Battle of Britain. In the summer and fall of 1940, German and British air forces clashed in the skies over the United Kingdom, locked in the largest sustained bombing campaign to that date, a significant turning point of World War II. The Battle of Britain ended when Germany's Luftwaffe failed to gain air superiority over the Royal Air Force despite months of targeted bombings of Britain's air bases, military posts, and ultimately its civilian populations and London itself. Britain's decisive victory saved the country from a ground invasion and possible occupation by German forces, while proving that air power could be used to win a major battle. It just couldn't be done. Britain sustained incredible damage, but they survived. As I mentioned, the B-1 and B-2 rockets that Hitler launched at the end were too little, too late. And of course, by splitting his armies and attacking Russia. His war on two fronts eventually became his demise. And so there are many elements that captured our attention and gave credence to the concept that God, in fact, did intervene many times and many ways to save Britain and to preserve Ephraim and Manasseh, for he had other things for them to do. Now let's take a look at some of the biblical perspective on this matter as we look at the two sons of Joseph and the promises given to them. Notice here in Genesis chapter 48. I won't take the time to go back to Abraham. We will go here to Genesis as Joseph comes before Jacob, his father, and seeks a blessing for his sons in Genesis chapter 48. Verse 17, now when Joseph saw that his father laid his right hand on the head of Ephraim, it displeased him, because Ephraim was the younger son. So he took hold of his father's hand to remove it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's head. And Joseph said to his father, not so, my father, for this one is the firstborn. Put your right hand on his head. But his father refused and said, I know, my son, I know. He also shall become a people, and he also shall be great. But truly his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his descendants shall become a multitude of nations. And that, of course, is Ephraim. Verse 20, so he blessed them that day, saying, Jacob blessed the two sons of Joseph. By you, Israel will bless. By both of you sons, both of you, Ephraim and Manasseh, you will be so blessed that down through the centuries and the history of Israel, all of the sons, the saying will become, by you, Israel will bless, saying, may God bless you as he blessed, if you will, Ephraim and Manasseh. May you be as blessed as they were. So the great promises given to Abraham, passed down through Isaac and Jacob, are now coming down to the two sons of Joseph. The other sons receive their blessings, and many of them, as we know, and as we suspect, I should say, migrated to Western Europe, and their descendants are there. Their descendants are scattered in other countries and other situations. But when you look at Ephraim and the promise of becoming a multitude of nations down through the centuries and down through history, can you find any other country that meets this criteria and these circumstances? I haven't. If you can, please let the rest of us know. This is remarkable. Then Israel said to Joseph, behold, I am dying, but God will be with you and bring you back to the land of your fathers. Moreover, I have given you one portion above your brothers, which I took from the hand of the Amorite with my sword and my bow. So he blessed the sons of Joseph and gave Joseph a gift. But the point is, Ephraim and Manasseh were blessed, and Manasseh would become a great nation. Ephraim would become a great company of nations. And isn't it interesting that out of Ephraim came Manasseh, the 13 colonies, and off we go. Deuteronomy chapter 33, Moses, in reviewing the blessings to each of the sons, makes some interesting comments here in Deuteronomy chapter 33. Verse 13. And of Joseph he said, blessed of the Lord is his land, with the precious things of heaven, with the dew and the deep lying beneath, with the precious fruits of the sun, with the precious produce of the months, with the best things of the ancient mountains, with the precious things of the everlasting hills, with the precious things of the earth and its fullness, and the flavor of him, the favor of him, rather, who dwelt in the bush. Is that the burning bush? Let the blessing come on the head of Joseph and on the crown of the head of him who was separate from his brothers. Of course, that's Joseph, separated from his brothers. His glory is like a firstborn bull and his horns like the horns of the wild ox. Together with them, he shall push the peoples to the ends of the earth. They are 10,000s of Ephraim, and they are thousands of Manasseh. 10,000s of Ephraim, thousands of Manasseh. People pushed to the ends of the earth. The colonizing of the European, the British Empire, rather. And their influence, both in world trade, in the foodstuffs that they traversed all over the world, the tremendous influence they had on world trade and commerce and banking and investment. All of these factors came into play as Ephraim rose to prominence. And although the small island nation did not have all of the physical land that Manasseh had, they had access to a worldwide market of incredible variety and abundance, be it natural elements and resources, foodstuffs, cloth, wool, industrial products, and of course, when you factor in the Industrial Revolution and other elements that propelled society and culture forward in the 1900s and in the 20th century, all of this comes into focus. But isn't this interesting, as even Moses explains that Ephraim had his 10,000s and Manasseh his thousands? And a look at history tends to confirm it, doesn't it? Now, in Leviticus chapter 26, this is one of the two famous blessings and cursings chapters. And here in Leviticus 26, we find that God is going to warn Israel about what will happen if they don't obey him, if they don't keep his laws and his commandments. He constantly warned them about the dangers involved, as did Moses. But notice here in verse 18 of Leviticus 26. And after all this, if you do not obey me, then I will punish you seven times more for your sins. I will break the pride of your power. I will make your heavens like iron and your earth like bronze. In other words, drought. Your strength shall be spent in vain, for your land shall not yield its produce, nor shall the trees of the land yield their fruit. And of course, Israel went into captivity. They became known as the lost 10 tribes of Israel. And much of the breaking of the pride of their power and the drought and the famines and the other plagues that are counted in as part of the end time prophecies did not actually come upon ancient Israel. They are yet reserved for modern Israel. And we are going to see, as we go through this series, that our nation is on the brink of making the same mistake that Israel made. As it says in verse 18, after all of this, if you do not obey me, then I will punish you seven times more for your sins. And we have interpreted this seven times as a prophetic measurement of time, totaling 2,520 years, a day for a year. And in keeping with our discussion, Israel, of course, prophesied to be punished seven times more for their sins. Their descendants were punished for 2,520 years. The promised blessings that were given to Abraham were still going to be granted to the modern-day descendants, Ephraim and Manasseh, that had not yet been accomplished. And in the year 1800, or thereabouts, between 1800 and 1803, marks basically 2,520 years from the time of Israel's captivity in 721-718 B.C. to the time when Britain and America suddenly exploded. The Louisiana Purchase, the acquisition of overseas possessions by Britain, the expansion of the Commonwealth. They both, as major nations, came into possession of incredible wealth and greatness and abundance. Together, they, the British and Americans, descendants of the tribe of Joseph, or the family of Joseph, came into possession of more than two-thirds, almost three-fourths, of all the cultivated resources and wealth in the world. That's a quote from the United States and the British Commonwealth in Prophecy by Mr. Armstrong, Herbert Armstrong. Together, the British and the Americans, descendants of Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh, his two sons, came into possession of more than two-thirds, almost three-fourths, of all the cultivated resources and wealth of the world. Remarkable. And again, testimony to the exceptional nature of these two nations, or if you will, the single nation and the company of nations, as they're described in Scripture. Now, America. Let's focus there for a moment. The land of opportunity, where men are viewed as having an equal opportunity for success, living in a culture and a society that encourages individuals to follow their dreams, refine their talents, work hard to achieve their goals, and take responsibility for themselves, their families, and their futures. If you've ever visited Ellis Island, how many of you have visited Ellis Island, where many of the immigrants landed on the shores of America, welcomed by the Statue of Liberty? Many, many people have come to America with the hope of succeeding, with the hope of owning their own property, owning their own business, owning their own home, succeeding and achieving in their personal lives, gaining an education, gaining an income, succeeding in their lives. America has consistently, over the years, offered that hope. And, of course, it has had the unique combination of resources, of geography, and laws and government to provide those opportunities for people who came here and native-born sons. Many of these principles are part of what many have come to call capitalism. Capitalism, which is defined as a socio-economic system founded upon individual rights. And essentially, that is what we find here in America. Not strictly or purely, I'm saying in general terms. The economic system that we have labored under and worked under is essentially a capitalistic system, where people are responsible for themselves. And government intervention has been minimum. But some of those things are starting to change. To give you a little bit of a clearer view on capitalism, I have some quotes from Winston Churchill. And some of them are quite entertaining. And I think they all give definition to the concept of capitalism. Certainly it's not perfect. No humanly devised system is perfect, but when any humanly devised system relies upon the laws and commandments and principles of God to exist, and any system created with those laws and commandments in mind can have quite a positive outcome. Here are some quotes from Mr. Churchill regarding capitalism. "The inherent vice of capitalism is the unequal sharing of blessings. The inherent virtue of socialism is the equal sharing of misery." Some see private enterprise as a predatory target to be shot, others as a cow to be milked, but few are those who see it as a sturdy horse pulling the wagon. It can be viewed as all three of those. Again, from Churchill, "We contend that for a nation to tax itself into prosperity is like a man standing in a bucket trying to lift himself up by the handle." I can imagine that. I don't think I want to try it. Churchill's use of opposing ideas to illustrate the strengths and weaknesses of capitalism reinforces the fact that no humanly devised system of governance is perfect. Neither America's or anyone else's, for that matter. And of course, as we look at the blessings that our nation has enjoyed, we should look to God, the giver of every good gift. But we can also look at the principles upon which our nation was founded and realize that as their origins can be traced back to God and His Word, so we can expect to see successful outcomes. Sir William Blackstone was an 18th century English jurist. He wrote commentaries on the laws of England. It is the best known description of the doctrines of English law. His work became the basis of university legal education in England and in North America. He was knighted in 1770. Here's what he has to say about what he calls the natural rights of man. "These rights, which God and nature have established, are therefore called natural rights, such as are life and liberty. These need not the aid of human laws to be more effectually invested in every man than they are. Neither do they receive any additional strength when declared by the municipal laws to be inviolable." So he calls these natural rights that no law needs to reinforce and no law can deprive you of. And he determines those or defines those as life and liberty, at least two of them. Now, again, I'd like to give you a little more background before we dive into the scriptures here. First of all, from America's Declaration of Independence. These rights are defined, and the same verbiage essentially is used. It's interesting to note as we listen to the Declaration what prompted the founders of our nation to separate themselves from Britain. Listen to the words of the Declaration. "When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation." That's fancy verbiage for saying we're going to tell Britain why we're leaving. "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal." Now, that needs a great deal of definition, because really, all men are not created equal. We are quite different in many respects, but we are all equal in the rights that we have been given by our Creator, according to the Declaration. "All men are created equal. They are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. In other words, it's not working, Britain. Taxation without representation was only one example. There were many other examples. And the colonists were attempting to recapture the natural rights of man as Sir William Blackstone defined them in his commentaries on the laws of England, for England had lost sight of those rights and those laws when it came to dealing with the colonies. Now, these words put in the context of the struggle between the colonies and their British masters, make it clear that the fledgling nation, America, was looking for the restoration of freedom and natural rights. I have another quote here. This is from a book entitled The 5,000 Year Leap. Some of you may have heard of this. Written by W. Cleon Skousen. He defines and explores what he calls 28 principles and freedom, principles of freedom our founding fathers said must be understood and perpetuated by every people who desire peace, prosperity, and freedom. He suggests that adherence to these principles by our nation over the past 200 years has brought about more progress than was made in the previous 5,000 years, hence the title of the book. The 5,000-year leap. Now, in this quotation, he attempts to describe what he believes the founder's definition of equality is. All men are created equal. The founders distinguish between equal rights and other areas where equality is impossible. They recognize that society should seek to provide equal opportunity, but not expect equal results. Provide equal freedom, but not expect equal capacity. Provide equal rights, but not equal possessions. Provide equal protection, but not equal status. Provide equal educational opportunities, but not equal grades. The freedom of choice, coupled with the diversity of human gifts and talents, ensures the inequality of outcomes when it comes to human beings. Some believe that equal rights cannot be achieved unless everyone has equal things. Now, when government intervenes to establish that kind of egalitarian society, or everyone is equal, the likely or natural outcome is totalitarianism. Now, I'd like to take a look at some biblical principles regarding our Creator's laws, commandments, and statutes that clearly seem to have influenced our founding fathers as they established our nation's governing principles and documents. We're going to start this examination. I'm going to go through a couple of them, and then we're going to continue this discussion in part two. We are going to find that many of the biblical principles that we are going to look at in these verses as we scan the scriptures and look for hints and clues as to how economy should work and how men should labor and relate and interrelate with one another in the workplace. We're going to see many parallels between what the Bible has to say and what our founding fathers established in our founding documents. Let's begin in 2 Thessalonians chapter 3. We'll look at a couple of them here, and we'll explore many more in part 2. 2 Thessalonians chapter 3. Verse 10. For even when we were with you, we commanded you this: if anyone will not work, neither shall he eat. That's a fairly straightforward principle, isn't it? Now, notice there needs to be clarification of not being willing to work is far different than not being able to work. It's the willingness that's being looked at here. For even when we were with you, we commanded you this, if anyone will not work, neither shall he eat. Now, there were some difficulties in Thessalonica with people who were not working. They were going from house to house. They were busybodies. They were apparently gossiping, eating other people's food and not working. As you read in verse 11, verse 12, Paul continues, now those who are such, we command and exhort through our Lord Jesus Christ that they work in quietness and eat their own bread. Now, again, looking at this in principle, work is a very important part of God's plan for mankind. The importance of work, productive labor, was illustrated by God Himself, who created the heavens and the earth, who worked hard, if you will, for 6 days, if God can work hard. He worked for 6 days, He rested on the seventh. He gave us commandments. He gave one commandment relevant to the Sabbath, in which He said, 6 days shall you work and accomplish all of your personal things. Work has always been a very strong ethic in the Scripture and in God's plan. And it's not to say, by looking at Exodus chapter 20 and the commandment, that we have to work 6 days a week. The principle is work. God Himself worked and labored. He benefited from His labors. He expects us to benefit from our labors. And so the concept of work is emphasized not only here in 2 Thessalonians, but as I mentioned, in Exodus chapter 20, verses 8 and 9, where you read the commandment regarding the Sabbath. Let's go there and make sure we get all of the wording. In Exodus chapter 20, verses 8 and 9. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all of your work. So labor and work, very important, and a part of God's plan for all of us. The seventh day, of course, we're to rest from our labors. But we have those 6 days to work, and it is an important aspect of our calling and our responsibility as human beings to work, not just for ourselves, but for our children, but for our mates. We work together. We work individually. We are productive. And that is what God expects human beings to be and to become. In Ephesians chapter 4, little tidbit here, Ephesians chapter 4. Ephesians 4, verse 28. Let him who stole steal no longer. Well, there's another commandment. Stop stealing. And once you do, what are you supposed to do? You start laboring. You start working. Don't steal. Don't take someone else's product of his labor. You work for your own. You labor. You work with your hands, doing that which is good, that which is honest. And don't take it all for yourself. Make sure that you have something to give to him who has need. So that's a very important part of the work ethic, is that you not only have enough for yourself, but you have something to give to someone who is in need, because God is very concerned about those who are in need and those who are poor, because even as Christ said, the poor you will always have with you. Now, there are many more scriptural principles that we're going to cover and expand next time. We're going to talk about the Jubilee. We're going to talk about property ownership. We're going to talk about income and interest, and we're going to talk about a lot of different things relevant to economy and work, personal responsibility and ethics, laws and commandments and principles that are in the Scripture that have affected our nation and its success to some extent and some degree. And many of the principles that our founding fathers recognized as biblical or godly, and many of those principles that were folded into our documents, are now being questioned and are now, in some cases, being reversed. And it is a frightening and challenging situation in which we find ourselves. And yet, as we read prophetically, this has been prophesied to come to pass. Israel is going to encounter these kinds of things as they continue to stray from their God and disobey His laws and commandments. It's a foregone conclusion. So, American exceptionalism, is it true? Is it really an exceptional country? Well, we'll look more into that next time. We'll try to answer the question more fully and explore the biblical principles upon which this nation was founded, and once again emphasize the blessings of God that He gave to the descendants of Abraham, Ephraim, and Manasseh.